Welcome back to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn, and with me in the studio once again, Neely Pelling of the New Hanover County DSS and Liz Kakris-Jones from Guardian Ad Litem. We're talking about foster care and foster parenting. If you have a question for our guests today, or if you have an experience in the foster care system as a child or as a parent, give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can also send us an email at coastline@whqr.org. Or tweet us at CoastlineHQR. And we do have an email question from Paul. He says, my partner and I have discussed fostering a child as an unmarried gay couple. How does that work? Are there laws against this? And has legal gay marriage improved the ability to foster? Finally, we are considering getting married here in North Carolina. Should we wait to foster until we do? Neely Pelling.
Well, we have always licensed same-sex couples, married couples, single people. I mean, we need all kinds of foster families, so that's never been an issue. What we've seen, what has changed as far as same-sex couples and adopting is that now both people in the relationship can adopt, which has been huge, because before it wasn't recognized as a union and only one of the foster parents could adopt. So like I had mentioned earlier, a lot of times the state, if there's any major life change, such as a marriage or a divorce, birth of a child, death of someone that's close to you, they like for you to wait about a year before you pursue licensing. So if you are going to get married, you might want to wait a little while just to kind of settle in. Or if you're not, we would love to talk to them, and we would love to license them and talk to them about becoming foster parents.
Do you ever license single people?
Yes.
Single men, single women?
Predominantly, I mean, I don't know. I think we have had some single men, more so single women, and sometimes single parents. Sometimes they don't have children, but absolutely. I mean, we look at everyone, and we don't discriminate, because foster kids just need a home that can provide structure and love and, you know, routine and nurturance, and a lot of different people can provide that.
How much more complicated is fostering, say, a teenager than a child who's 8 years old? And what kinds of issues is a potential foster parent likely to encounter if they agree to foster a teenager?
Wow. There's different challenges with all of the ages. I mean, teens come into care having so many life experiences. And if you are putting a teenager that has come from a lot of chaos and not a lot of structure or routine, and then try to put them in a home that you know, is a foster family that's trying to provide house rules and structure, and there can be a lot of tension with that. There can be a lot of pushback with you know, with teens. It can be difficult. But then sometimes there are teens, and this kind of goes back to Liz saying it depends, because it really just depends on the child. But sometimes there are teens that really want to get out of that chaotic home life, and they want to have someone who is predictable and stable and will offer them a place to live and a safe home where they can go to school and concentrate on school. And so it really just depends on the child and what their needs are. There's really no easy question or answer as far as, you know, the different issues you might have at different ages, because some 8-year-olds have just as many issues as maybe, you know, a 14-year-old. I mean, if that's like the oldest child in a sibling group, then no matter what their age, they really are kind of adultified and take care of their younger siblings and think that they're in a role where they're in charge. And so that can be a real challenge with foster parents trying to help kids just be kids and not try to take care of everything.
And what kind of services do you provide for foster parents? Because that would be, in a lot of cases, I imagine, a larger responsibility, dealing with a kid who has all kinds of trauma.
Sure.
And all
sure.
kinds of issues.
Yeah, we try to give them a lot of support. We offer ongoing trainings for them. We have monthly meetings for the Foster Parent Association where they can get training that will really help them in their day-to-day parenting of kids that are in foster care. We try to give them, you know, some of the things that they really need to to be kind of experts on are loss and grief, because all of these kids have experienced, you know, profound loss by being removed from their birth home. And we also look at trying to give them the tools they need to manage behaviors. We just try to give them as much support. We also set them up with other foster parents that have been as like a mentor that have been fostering for longer. So they have a social worker, but they also have someone that they can call if, you know, they need help or need some advice. And we just really try to give them as much support, because it can be very challenging, and we want them to know how much we need them and how much we appreciate them. And, you know, they're doing it from such a good place, and a lot of them have parented. But that doesn't necessarily prepare them for parenting a foster child, because they just come in with so many more needs because of all the chaos and stress that they've had in their life and trauma.
Liz Kakros-Jones, in your years in the system, you must have seen a lot of kids come and go. Have you seen kids grow up and move on to productive careers? And what is that like for you when you watch a kid grow up in the system?
I'm going to answer that by partly kind of following on what Neela just said. So the Guardian Ad Litem program has a very clear mandate about the best interest, and there are lots of supports that foster parents need, and they are to me, and I always say this when I get a chance to speak with them, they are what make this process work. Children need a place to go, and they are willing to be there at a moment's notice to help children manage what's happening in a very chaotic and traumatic time. And so they need all the supports that the department can offer them, and they need a lot of internal supports for themselves and some really good skills. Having said that, the Guardian Ad Litem program has an association, and we try to help with some of those things that the department can't manage. So things like, it's very expensive. Our kids are often behind in school because they've had some instability. So they need to get up to grade level if they're going to be successful, which is kind of to the point of your question. So we offer, we have an association that raises money to help provide things like tutoring and enrichment experiences for our children who are with the Guardian Ad Litem program. And it allows them to kind of focus on being a kid, but get up to grade level, feel some success, so that we get tickets to the aquarium and the battleship and to shows and to just normal experiences that they may not have had, in addition to some of those academic supports. And those things then allow for them to move forward if they're older, so that we've seen some real successes for kids. They now have the supports of what is kind of independent living in the Lynx program if they're older and they age out. Age out children are very important to me and sensitive to me. That means they never got permanence. And so some of them have gone on to college.
And when you say, just to be clear, never got permanence, you mean they were either never adopted or they never were able to go back to their family homes?
Yes. Thank you for kind of clarifying that. It means that they never got out of the system before they turned 18. So could have been, you know, permanence for us is not being in DSS custody when you turn 18. Yeah. And so sometimes they've gone on to college. Sometimes they've gone on to vocational training. Sometimes with the combined efforts of the department and the association for Guardian Ad Litem, they've gotten skills or supports, kind of concrete supports around that. And lots of community partners have been responsible for that, and we appreciate every one of those folks. To say that, I want to just also not kind of override the fact that children who do age out are most likely to experience homelessness in their first year. They're most likely to be a victim of a crime their first year out. They're most likely to be in need of mental health services, unemployment services, to be a teen parent. I mean, there are so many things that come up for our youth who don't get that permanent caregiver and permanent support system that the programs that are now evolving around that in terms of independent living are crucial for their success into adulthood.
And these programs now are potentially getting support in the General Assembly. There are at least a couple of pieces of legislation working their way through. The Foster Care Family Act, how would that help some of these programs? Liz Kakros-Jones.
Okay. So I don't remember kind of all the details of all these proposed bills because they get changed along the way.
This one is the reasonable and prudent parenting standard providing liability insurance.
That would be huge for foster parents because that is looking at giving foster parents more parental decisions and letting them allow foster children that are staying with them to go and stay with a friend, to have a sleepover at a friend's house, to go on a church youth trip over the weekend or, you know, a school trip, go to prom, even like pursue getting their driver's license, where those have all been decisions that have had to be made by the agency where they're in custody. So we're really excited about that because so many kids are in foster care because of no fault of their own. And then they really feel like they're kind of victimized by foster care. And we want them, you know, we want to provide them with a normal life and some normalcy. And they're like, but it's not normal. I can't spend the night at my friend's house or go to prom without having my DSS worker say it's okay. So we're really excited about that. And I think that the federal legislation on that one has passed and we're waiting on the state legislation. But I think that's really a great step towards normalizing foster care and giving foster parents more decisions, decision-making's part of what the foster kids can do.
And there's also another bill, Fostering Success, which is about extending the age of emancipation to 19. Liz Kakris-Jones, can you tell us about that?
Well, I feel like that's a really critical one as well because, as I was saying earlier, if they have school instability, their likelihood of finishing school on time at around 18 has been diminished by the fact that they've probably moved around in schools. And so we often are encouraging them to voluntarily allow the department to help them stay on until they finish school. And so if we don't have to have that negotiation and just allow them to stay where they are until they can finish school at the age of 19, which is often that 1 year makes a big difference, not only in terms of finishing school, but then establishing skills like how do I get a lease? How do I apply for jobs appropriately? How do I open a bank account? How do I navigate my life as an adult when that type of learning typically happens in a family unit? And so we want to make sure that they have the skills to be successful. And so few 19-year-olds are prepared for those skills.
So when a child reaches the age of 18 as it stands right now, then they are no longer with their foster family. Is that correct? That door just closes?
They can choose to be with their foster family, but they can choose not to be. And so depending on, you know, like many teenagers all over the world, they often think they're fully prepared to be on their own, and then a month later they find out, I don't know how to do a lease. I don't know how to find my own housing. I don't know where to go to get help on any number of things. And so it's really important for them to be able to have time to learn those skills before they make the decision that they don't need the supports of a family around them. It gives them another year, and that's good.
Neely Pelling, how many kids who find foster homes wind up getting adopted?
Last year, we had 65 children that were in foster care that were adopted by either a foster family or by a relative. And that's a pretty significant number. I mean, we really want kids to have permanence. And it can be frustrating for foster parents feeling like, you know, that it does take a while to get to that point. And sometimes kids have been in the same foster home or with a relative for 2 and 3 years and still working that plan of reunification with the parents. And so we really do try to push for permanence for kids. We don't want them aging out of foster care. You know, statistics show that foster care is not a good place for kids to be to be raised, basically, you know, where you're in foster care. So we really push for that, and it comes to a certain point where the birth family isn't doing what they need to do, and we try to move forward as quickly as we can to provide permanence for children. And we have a lot of people that come to us and want to adopt, and I always tell them that that will happen. It might not be the first placement that you have, but if you hang in there with us and you continue to open your heart and your home, we do have plenty of kids that need a forever home.
And just briefly, how many of those kids who were adopted, of those 65, were younger than 12, and how many were older? Do teenagers ever get adopted?
They do. They do. We have, I would say, I don't know what the statistics are. Most of them were probably under 12, but we do have teenagers that are adopted. One of my foster families just recently finalized an adoption of a 16-year-old that has been in their home for the past, I believe he's been there for 2 or 3 years, and they were very committed to him, and he is definitely a teenager with all the things that come along with being a teenager, but they're very committed to him and excited about the future, and it's stories, you know, like that kind of keep us going, because there are really special people out there that want to help teens. You know, I mean, some people are very hesitant to do that, but you know, they're kids, they're teenagers, and all that entails.
That's a great final thought. Liz, just a few seconds left. If you could get one message across about guardian ad litem to the public, what would it be?
That the role of the volunteer is an incredibly powerful and rewarding one, and that it's a great way to be in your community if you care about children, and work with a number of really great professionals.
That's this edition of Coastline. I'd like to thank our guests, Neely Pelling from New Hanover County's DSS and Liz Kakris-Jones of Guardian Ad Litem. Thanks also to you, our listeners. Join us for next week's Coastline when we take a closer look at diversity on campus. We'll meet UNCW's first diversity officer. That's next Wednesday at 12:06 here on HQR News 91.3 FM. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.